Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week on Soundbites, we're going to take a look at two disturbing statistics relating to food in this country. In the United States, we throw away nearly half of our food. Journalist Jonathan Bloom, author of the new book American Wasteland, joins us in the second half of the show to discuss why we waste so much food and what we can do about it. First, we'll take a look at another sobering statistic. The youngest generation of Americans is the first in this country's history with a lower life expectancy than their parents. According to Anim Steele, one of our guests this week, this disturbing trend is partly a result of what we eat. Anim is director of national programs at the Food Project in Boston. Through his Real Food Project, he's working to transform our food system by encouraging colleges and universities to purchase $1 billion in local food by 2020. Here's my conversation with Anim Steele. I asked him to start by explaining his work.
What I work on in particular is our program called the Real Food Challenge, which is a national program. The Food Project in Boston is a nonprofit that hires 150 teenagers a year. We grow 250,000 pounds of produce on urban farms and peri-urban farms. It's a very hopeful community of youth and adults who are doing positive things for the community. And we've taken that kind of spirit and translated it into a national program called the Real Food Challenge that is based on college campuses. What we're doing with that is looking at the $5 billion that colleges spend each year on feeding their students and seeing that as an opportunity to support the kind of agriculture, family farms, fair trade that, you know, is going to help our communities be more sustainable and livable. And I got into it about 10 years ago, actually this year, when I was looking for the best way I could serve the various communities and countries that I call home. So I grew up in West Africa. I was born in Ghana, as you mentioned. My mother is from Ghana, she's Ashanti, and my father is from the Midwest. He's of Eastern European and Scots-Irish background.
Mm-hmm.
So I was born over there when they met in the late 60s, actually the same year that interracial marriage was adjudicated in the courts in the United States, was the year that they met.
1967.
Yeah, 67, exactly.
Right.
And I came along not that long afterward. I grew up in both West Africa and childhood in West Africa, teen years in the DC area actually. And after pursuing my dream of working in the space program, and I majored in astrophysics and thought that was my future, I really found in the end that I was pulled to work in struggling communities that I in some ways was in various ways was feeling connected with, and I've always wanted to, since I have family both in the States and in Africa, I decided that making a difference is what I wanted to do. I really wanted to do it in the way that benefited both. And food was the thing that I found that you could do that with. So that led me to the food project ultimately, and to this amazing community. And it was in the course of sharing our model with people from all over the country that I met college students who were picking up that call on their campuses, and I and some of the other students and folks that I met realized, like, we can't let this opportunity to make a difference go by. So we're now aiming to shift $1 billion worth of food purchases, annual food purchases, away from the typical business as usual, kind of conventional agribusiness, towards small farmers here and abroad, socially responsible food businesses. And we've so far shifted $45 million worth of annual food purchases, including the entire University of California system and plenty of other places across the country. And we've also created a real food calculator, which is a tool for measuring. Hey, what do we mean when we say real food? And, you know, how do you know what that is? Well, we've kind of collected the definitions and created something that any student and schools can use to track their progress. So that's a little bit of my story, and that's part of why, you know, I ended up looking out through this door in the one of the old slave forts in West Africa. I was there visiting my family. That's kind of, I guess, how we came in touch with each other, is through that story that I told.
It was very poignant, because you just think that, you know, the way that the world works, your people before you were just lucky they weren't in that door to nowhere.
You know, Mark, you're absolutely right. It's my personal, you know, history does not pass through that door, right? My descent, my ancestors, my African ancestors didn't come that way. But as an African American, you know, I spent most of my adult life with a African American black identity in this country, when I stand there, I kind of see it from these multiple perspectives. It's both as someone, you know, whose family is African, but also as someone who, you know, my worldview and associations and you know, deep bonds have been shaped by being a black American. So I really felt that the presence of, like, suffering and survival that you, I think, couldn't help feeling when you're looking out of the door through which millions of human beings passed. I still felt a personal link to that. Maybe probably different than if I knew my ancestors were there, but it was still a sharp and a real feeling.
So the work that you're doing, I mean, the heart of it here, the idea of whether it's the food project and the real food challenge that comes out of the food project to change how we purchase our foods, but it's more than that. It's about really. It seems to me, and you can describe it for yourself, but that it's about raising consciousness and changing the food system at the same time.
Yeah, they think there's a lot of work to be done, and the changing how the dollars are spent is important in of itself, and it is also pulling at a larger thread of consciousness. And you know, in some ways, that relates to what I was describing as I looked through that door, and I realized something that I hadn't really kind of been aware of before, when I had also visited that slave fort, which was I understood that the foundation of our modern world, in some ways, was in a lot of ways, was this the rise of this global food economy. I mean, it was because there was agriculture and there was cotton and rice and sugar, you know, being grown from the t- tip of South America all the way, you know, through to Baltimore, on these plantations. That was the engine, in a way, driving this the emerging global world. And you know, if you stand at that spot in almost any year, the last 400 years, let's just say in 1600, you know that, and you see that very clearly, that it is food and agriculture that is the kind of the base of our economy and ultimately our well-being. It determines how healthy we are, how wealthy we are, and who is being treated well and who isn't. That is still true. It's just a lot less obvious today, right? I mean, as someone who's grown mostly in cities, I don't think it was something I was very conscious of. So as I looked through that door, I understood that this was the foundation of the world that we've created with all its kind of great things about it and its long-term tragedies and injustices, and that we have a lot of, you know, the work of improving it continues from what people were doing in back in those times to make their lives better. So I see our work as with the Real Food Challenge, with the Food Project, and with what Will Allen does, and with what the whole real food movement is doing, as in some ways as a continuation of the very first campaign for human rights in the world, which was the British anti-slavery campaign. You know, they boycotted Caribbean West Indian sugar as one of the very first really public actions of this movement. So the very first human rights campaign had a food element to it, and I think what we're doing is continuing to do that. And ultimately, as you mentioned, we've got to change consciousness. We've got to change policy, and we need to create alternatives. Actually, I almost think about it using another metaphor from the struggle of black freedom. I think about it like this: we have to we need Emancipation Proclamation, mm-hmm. or our equivalent of it. And by that I mean policy needs to change from the very top. You know, the kind of the law of the land should go to support food and agriculture that is healthy for people and the earth. It's not that way right now, and the Farm Bill is one example of that. But that alone is not enough. Even if the policy changed tomorrow, there'd be a lot of work to be done. So I also think about, we also need to have our 40 acres and a mule, meaning that what actually happens on the ground, on the farms and aquaculture ponds and all the places of food production all over this country and world, that actually has to change. That's the very kind of like what's happening on the soil, the economics of it needs to change. And that's in some ways where the Real Food Challenge comes in, because we're giving the incentive, direct incentives for changing what happens on the land. But even that's not enough. You have your Emancipation Proclamation, you have your 40 acres and a mule, but you also need the equivalent of the I Have a Dream moment, where the consciousness of the, you know, of society changes, and it's no longer okay to have food that is not doing what it's supposed to do, to have food that is really, almost not too dramatic to say, killing people. It's certainly shortening lifespans. What we have now, that's the opposite of what food really should be, and that's why we call it real food. Food should nourish the body, it should nourish the soil, it should nourish communities. When it doesn't do that, does it really deserve the title real food? So we're looking for a real food system that truly nourishes community, the earth, and people, both consumers and producers.
How do you see that struggle playing itself out? I mean, there's so much seems to be going on in America right now around that issue. whether it's the challenge to genetically modified seeds and food with Monsanto and the rest, or whether it is the issues around CAFOs and then people wanting to have urban agriculture developed and creating health and high school students demanding better food in their schools and people just growing more conscious of it, because we're also in a world where a lot of times the healthiest food for us becomes the food that only wealthy can afford. You know, so it's a complex issue out there. And I wonder how you think it's going to unfold. Not that you're prescient, but but how you think it's going to unfold in the coming years as part of the struggle to change for a world that's more just for everyone.
I do think there are so many issues that connect to this. So it was hard for me to like kind of grasp the fullness of it. We talk about an image that we call a real food wheel as a way to express kind of all of the issues that are present when we talk about food, from health to climate, to all of those things that you've mentioned and more. I'm acknowledging that there's a lot to think about, and I think one thing that I would like to see happen, that I guess we're trying for, is to develop more of a common understanding about those linkages, to talk like it's one movement with many different objectives rather than very disparate things. So when we started the Real Food Challenge, we started really because we had folks who cared about fair trade and those people working on farm workers' rights and students who were pushing for organic food and other students who were trying to get local food in their dining halls, all those different things. We said, let's come together and create something, kind of amplify all our efforts. So that's one thing that I think, we need to keep doing. There are some practical limits to that, but that's one direction. Of course, an economy where we can have living wages and fair access to opportunity is going to do a lot to help food security, because poverty is what will prevent people from affording good food. So that is a separate but related issue. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing in terms of direction is to keep supporting young people, especially those who are standing up for themselves, to demand real food, to keep their grandmother's recipes alive, and to change the system. And that's happening already. So I think I see a lot of hope in the younger generation, who are the generation that is going to suffer most from the consequences of bad food. One of the things that I loved was a group in North Carolina called Seed in Durham. The teens there took upon themselves a 30-day challenge to give up some piece of junk food or fast food that they they often ate, and then they went out to the community and they asked people to support them a couple cents a day, 25 cents. I mean, for each day that they resisted their, whether it was McDonald's or a soda or eating candy, and they actually raised $3,000 to attend a youth farm conference. So that's an idea we're working on right now, is making a national thing. We call it Bring Healthy Back. Inviting people and challenging people to cut something out, and at the same time raise funds for youth food projects in their community. I'm just using that as an example of how I see this movement going, and I think more of that would be that kind of thing.
And you see it happening. There's something you did that I read about just recently that I was not aware of. Maybe you could just tell the story, because I think it'd be really intriguing, which is this freedom ride you all took last year.
Oh yes, the food and freedom ride.
Yeah, I just found out about that, and I don't know the whole story, but it sounded as an old freedom rider myself, it sounded like a really fascinating thing. So talk about that.
Well, that's amazing, and it's really great to make that connection with you. We can talk more about that. We knew it was the 50th anniversary last year of the Freedom Ride, and as people born in the 70s and 80s, this is my colleagues and teammates and I, you know, we really looked to that generation and those events as our inspiration, but also we're aware that it has created, I'll speak personally, like my life would be nothing like what it is were it not for those folks who were you know, on the ride and marching and pressing for change. So we wanted to do something to commemorate that and show our appreciation for it, and at the same time, like, take the conversation to the next level, almost like update it, like, well, what is one of the most pressing issues today, especially an issue that doesn't get as much attention, in the same way that, in some ways, the civil rights movement back then, I think, didn't. It wasn't something that everyone wanted to rally around. Certainly the administration was not trying to, like, address it, you know. So we wanted to raise some, you know, attention to this issue. So we actually got a van and we did this ride, a kind of a north-south ride, but we did it in reverse. We started in the south in Birmingham, and we rode to Detroit, and we stopped at a bunch of places along the way. We actually passed through about 13 states altogether. We started actually with a meeting with civil rights, with folks who had been in Birmingham when the dogs and the houses the hoses were let loose on those kids. They were actually kids in the park as that was happening in 1963. So they were part of a community gathering that we had, and from there we proceeded northward. We, you know, Alabama and Mississippi were chosen partly for their relevance to the civil rights movement and the Freedom Rides, but also because they are they're ground zero for the obesity epidemic in this country. That's two of the states with the very highest obesity rates. So it's symbolic for that reason. But and we ended up in Detroit, which is the, in some ways, the symbol. It's become this way, anyway, the symbol of the old economy and of a new green economy rising in its ashes. The amazing community gardens, the Detroit Black Food Security Network group that is there was one of our hosts. So it was like riding into also a vision of the future. And we stopped. We passed through thousands of miles of corn and soybeans on either side along the way, and got to see what does agriculture look like in the middle of this country at scale. Kind of, we talked about, we were riding between, you know, from the hood to the heartland and everywhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
We had one stop at Mon in St. Louis, actually. After hearing, we went to Southern Illinois and we talked with some folks, a farmer and seed cleaners, who've been harassed by Monsanto Corporation. And so as we passed by St. Louis, we actually stopped at the Monsanto headquarters and pulled over and had a little ceremony there in solidarity with those farmers and in protest about what's happening. We immediately got surrounded by five cop cars and security cars. We were by the side of the road, so they couldn't do anything to us except take our pictures and ask lots of questions. Put an intimidating show, but we stayed there. So anyway, it was a fabulous trip, Mark. We're actually getting our videos up. We've been editing them for a while, and there, some of the clips are just about to go up on our website. That's a project called Live Real, and the website for that is liverealnow.org. It'll be a couple more days before the videos are up.
Well, we'll look forward to checking that out and maybe do some more on that after we see it. I can see that in many ways, I can hear it. It's just in, not just in the words you say and how you describe these events and what you're doing, but in your voice that just comes through, the tenor, that you have an optimism about the idea of organizing for a better food, a healthier food for all. I mean, you really feel it. You believe that it can happen.
I do, Mark. Appreciate you for picking that up. There's so many challenges. I know we're looking at a $1.1 trillion consumer food economy, of which currently less than 2% is of those food purchases. Are food that I would call real food, where it's not harming the earth or not contributing to global warming, or it's food that isn't handled by people who are being exploited or paid extremely low wages, or it's not a health. When you factor all that in, it's not a lot of food in our system, right? Which actually meets that criteria. And I know that criteria sounds like it's a lot, but I have to keep coming back to the point. Like, it's not. You know, our ancestors have managed to eat food that didn't ruin themselves or the earth forever. You know, people that our society calls primitive have managed to do this. I think as an advanced nation, we should accomplish this. So I understand that when you look at that picture, it's a long road to hope. It's not going to be simple, but I think we have truth on our side. I think we have, and I think the youth are on this side. I think people really, really want food that is social and ethical. I don't think they always want to think about it. I know I don't. I just want it to be that way. And I think the change has to be on the side that we're going for. Isn't there, there's a saying, I wonder if you know, remember who says this, that what amounts, often what amounts to change is nothing more than the truth coming in and out of fashion. Have you heard that? Remember who it is?
Yes.
I can't quite remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I like that one because I think in some ways that's what we're talking about. I mean, the idea that our food system has to be super mechanized and chemicalized and globalized is, that's been an interesting idea for a good many decades, but it's not what always was, and I think it flies in the face of human nature, and it certainly flies in the face of nature, and ultimately the nature and I think our basic human desires for health and goodness and connection are going to win out. So I get optimism for that, and I see it happening every day at the Food Project in Boston. I see teenagers, urban and suburban teenagers, who you would not think care to put their hand in the soil. I see them doing that, to me that's an incredible symbol of hope. Not that everyone is going to be a farmer or wants to, but that that real satisfaction and joy and jobs can come out of a real food economy, and we can build community out of it. I see it happening, so I have faith that it will grow.
Well, Anim Steel, this has been a pleasure. I know it won't be the last time we do this together, and I look forward to continuing deepening conversations and making this a better world for all of us. I appreciate you taking the time with us. I really
Mark,
do.
Terrific. Thank you. Thank you for letting these issues get talked about, and thank you also for being a freedom rider and someone who helped to pave the way for what we're doing now.
We're all together. Anim Steel, Director of National Programs for the Food Project. You're listening to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner, and we'll be right back after this brief break to talk with Jonathan Bloom, author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half Its Food, and what we can do about it. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center. providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-638-7781. Welcome back to Soundbites. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. As you know, we spend a lot of time on the show talking about the big picture of how our food system works, how we grow and distribute food, and how we can ensure that everyone has access to healthy, affordable, ecologically sound food. Up next, we'll hear about a solution to food shortages and the environmental impact of agriculture that starts not with a big policy fix, but what we do with the food in our own refrigerators. America throws away more than 40% of the food that we produce for consumption. And our next guest, Jonathan Bloom, has some ideas about why we must reduce that amount and how we can do it. His book is American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. And he blogs at www.wastedfood.com. Jonathan Bloom, welcome. Good to meet you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So this is really a very serious subject. You know, when my wife and I were talking about that I was going to reading this book, and she said, what are you reading? I said, American Wasteland. And she said, this is what I'm always saying, that we buy this food, and it sits in the fridge, and then we either throw it out or we throw it out to the raccoons in the back so they can eat it. So,
well, it's nice of you to feed the raccoons. I think within each marriage, within each couple, there's usually one person who laments the food waste, and then
she does a lot.
And then there's one person who's maybe trying to eat things a week or two after the expiration date. So
right. Well, my father was, you know, my father always said, and it made me think of this as I was reading your book. My pop always said, and he was a doctor, he always said, don't pay attention to the expiration labels on either medicine or food. They're all baloney. They're all BS. You can eat things way beyond that. Yeah. They just do that to make you buy new stuff, and you don't have to.
Yeah, well, that's what I preach, so it's good to get a second opinion on that. But yeah, I always say trust your senses before that date stamped on a package.
So one of the things I get a sense before we talk about this in your approach in many ways is that you kind of push both in your blog and in the book, consciously kind of not whipping people up about this, beating them over the head. It's kind of a kind of kinder, gentler way of approaching this subject.
Yeah, I mean, I try to trick people into learning, so to speak. and no one wants to be lectured to, and certainly people don't go to blogs to be lectured to. So I try to be approachable and get the message out there. But I think it's such a universal thing, eating and our approach to food, that it's only natural that people are going to be drawn to the topic and have these questions of, what happens at a restaurant at the end of the night? And what happens to the stuff on the salad bar at a supermarket when that store closes? So I'm just here to provide some answers and get people thinking.
Well, let's talk about really where you go with this. I mean, that at least 40% of all the food we produce in the United States is discarded, thrown away.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean? To break that down.
It's a great question. Yeah. So the best study we have looked at the number of calories produced in America, so everything raised or grown in the U.S., and then the calories consumed. And comparing those two numbers, they found that 40% of all the food we produce is not consumed. And it's actually interesting. This was an obesity researcher at the National Institute of Health who did this study, a guy named Kevin Hall. And it's a fascinating study, but it's what really strikes me is that we have to turn to an obesity researcher to get stats on food waste, that the USDA is not really looking at this issue. The last overarching study they did was in 1997, and it's a good while ago.
But two things pop in my head, and I think it's important, the stuff you wrote in the book. I mean, I'd like you to break down first what that 40% means.
Okay.
All right? And I want to kind of explore with you for a little bit why it's not important, why it's become – how it became an unimportant issue.
Okay.
From finish everything on your plate to is that an important issue? Well, let's start with what is in that 40% for us?
So what that means is that at every step of the food chain, food is being cast aside. And so it starts at the farm level where many goods don't ever leave the farm. There's a tremendous amount of what I call walk-bys, and some other folks call it that. Basically, goods aren't harvested because the price doesn't justify harvesting it. The price has become so low that it's not worth the labor or the diesel involved in harvesting. So a tremendous amount of food is just plowed under. Now, it's better than throwing it out. It's better than having it reach people's homes and end up in a landfill. But all the resources that go into producing that food and all the people who don't have enough to eat, for both those factors, we need to be getting more food harvested and distributed. The waste continues on to the supermarket level, to restaurants. Essentially, you start with a full pie, a full slice of all the food produced in this country, and every step of the food chain, there's a bite taken out of that pie through the food that we discard.
And, but it's not just, I mean, this is in restaurants. I have one little piece in this book, a number of pieces in this book. Something sticks in my head because you have a little thing, a paragraph about Whole Foods and how they have the stuff on display, or how other people have things on display. And rather than allowing people to take the food home or using the food, it's tossed.
Yeah, I mean, let's get into the reasons behind waste.
Right.
So, going back to the farm level, another reason some things never leave the farm is because they don't look quite right. And we've reached this point in our society where appearance of our food is more important than the taste, which to me is completely backwards. So everything has to look perfect. Things have to be the right size, shape, color, and there's a homogeneity that's really sought by the stores. So things often are cast aside at the farm level or maybe the wholesale level because of that, because they don't quite look right. Some other factors here, there's a cheapness to food, and that's a real driver for household waste.
Mm-hmm.
Now you might be thinking, hold on a sec, you know, I've been shopping the last couple of years and watching the food prices go up and up. But when you look at the percentage of our household spending that goes toward food, it's at an all-time low. It's only about 7% of household spending. So it's fairly simple. We don't tend to value things that we don't spend much on. So that helps us see food as disposable. So have half a sandwich, we're maybe out at lunch. Well, I'm not going to bother taking it home. I'll just toss it. And that kind of thinking really adds up. You know, there are plenty of households in this country, and the households, the waste coming from those households is a significant portion of that waste stream.
So, I mean, that you know, if you take it back a couple steps and we think about the numbers of people in this country and in this world who do not have enough to eat, the numbers of people who are living, as we call it in today's world, food insecurity.
Yeah,
like we put it these things, as you write.
What an ambiguous term.
I mean, yeah, we put those things there because we don't want to think about what they really mean.
Right? Yeah.
And you even wrote, I mean, that this whole notion of wasting food also kind of devalues all the people on this country and on the planet who don't have enough.
Yeah. So when I talk to people about food waste, the ethics is a real large component of this discussion. And to me, it's pretty straightforward. I'd say it's morally callous to throw out as much food as we do when so many people don't have enough to eat. You know, using that, our favorite term there, food insecurity, about 15% of Americans live in food insecure homes. So, you know, whatever we call it, there are plenty of people out there who aren't having enough to eat. And then there's another discussion of what kinds of foods they get to eat. But let's just think about nutrition and sustenance. So to have about 50 million Americans living in food insecure homes and to be throwing out, say, 40% of our food, to me, that just doesn't add up. And somewhere in the juxtaposition of those two numbers, there's a solution. There's an answer. And if you were to ask me what that is.
You want me to ask you what it is?
Please do.
No, no, really. Because, I mean, the last part of your book is all about.
Yeah.
How do you put it in your book? You don't see
it. If I were the king of the forest.
If you were the king of the forest, you say.
Yeah.
Right.
So, redistribution is a large answer for.
That's a very dangerous word in the United States. You know that?
Well,
redistribution.
Yeah. Not a popular one.
Go ahead.
Somehow getting that food that would otherwise be thrown out and distributing to people who need it. Food recovery organizations do a nice job doing that, cleaning operations, getting out there into the fields and harvesting all those crops that would otherwise be plowed under. That's one possible solution. The other thing is efficiency, and that's something that I think is going to become more of a buzzword as we get to this stage where there are 9 billion of us on the planet in 2050, and we try to figure out how to feed ourselves. So a lot of times people hear that figure of 9 billion people and they think, well, we're automatically going to have to turn to GMO crops. That may or may not be the case, but why wouldn't we focus on efficiency first? And to me, it's kind of the easy first step.
Now, one of the things I think that just was some things I hear you write about, which I think are important that for us to think about, the idea of food waste. Now, if I think I have these stats right from what you wrote, that an average family of four, we throw out an estimated $1,350 worth of food annually.
Yeah, that's a pretty conservative estimate.
A lot of these estimates are conservative. I mean, you write about Britain and places in Europe where they think it's much larger than we're saying here in America.
Yeah.
Our waste.
Yeah. I mean, a good ballpark guess is that about 25% of the food we bring into our homes we don't eat. And in the UK, they did a study and found that one-third,
right,
33% of food brought home is not eaten. So for a lot of reasons, it's not being used. I think, you know, just digging in on that a little bit more, we still shop as if we have time to cook, and we want to cook. We kind of have the idea that we're supposed to make these homemade meals, but we're busy. And so many families have two parents working. There's a lot of single-parent households and just not a lot of free time. So you might buy those fresh vegetables and fresh meat or whatever it may be to make that homemade meal, and you're getting off work at 7, you know, late again, and getting takeout somewhere. So that keeps happening. It keeps getting pushed off until the next day.
So, I mean, if that's the reality, I mean, and then, it's hard to change that. I mean, because that's one of the things I was thinking about. I wrote little notes to myself as I was reading your book, and one of the things is that this way that modern capitalism in some ways is part of that problem, whether it's cheap food, advertising, fast food, buy all these things you can stock in your soup, you know, in your cart and get it out the door, gigantic refrigerators, which you talk about in the book, where food gets lost, right?
Yeah. Well, supermarkets do have an incentive to oversell food, to make us buy too much. So that's why I think it's really important to create that meal plan, make a detailed shopping list, and really stick to it in the store and not get sucked in by these impulse buys, especially with perishable foods where things will go bad. But what's really interesting is in Britain, where supermarkets have the same incentive to sell us as much as possible, the stores have really gone the other direction and are pushing customers to not waste food. They're advertising campaigns on cutting waste at home. They're giving people recipes to use leftovers and really making it an issue. And to me, I think that's a wise way to play it. They're kind of getting on people's good sides, and it's the corporate social responsibility angle of getting people to say, hey, this store really is doing the right thing. And it is the right thing environmentally.
Why do you think they do it?
Well, I mean, they're trying to build loyalty in their customers, but it's what I'd call an enlightened move on their behalf. You know, they're doing the right thing, and hopefully they're rewarded for it with loyal customers.
So, if I remember correctly, you're saying 30 million pounds of food are thrown out every year from U.S. supermarkets. Was that the stat?
It sounds right. There's a lot of stats in there.
A lot of stats, but that's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I would call it staggering. At every level of the food chain, so much is thrown away.
And then goes where? That's
well,
the,
most
that's
of
the
it,
thing.
Well, sure, that is the thing. Most of it ends up in the landfill, unfortunately.
Right.
So, you know, there's this hierarchy of uses for food that the EPA put out. And obviously, first is eating it. If we can't eat that food, we should be trying to feed hungry people. If not that, feed livestock or animals, as we used to do in the old days with the hogs and the slop buckets. If you can't do that, there are a couple of waste-to-energy schemes out there. Anaerobic digestion is one. On down the list, till you get to composting. And to me, the very least that we should be doing is composting. To me, it wouldn't take much to get composting operations online, mm-hmm. more and more of them, and to really emphasize that, to get the nutrients from food back into the soil, rather than sending 97% of our food waste to landfill, which is what's happening now.
So I wonder how much of this is, for you, addressing this kind of huge waste issue. And it's a ton of, the amount of food we waste is amazing. And it also is how it's packaged and brought to us and why we buy it and these quantities we buy it. You can't buy one small cucumber. You've got to buy a whole package of small cucumbers.
Oh, that's such a pet peeve of mine. Yeah.
You too.
Yeah. That's the worst. Or that package of bell peppers, like the stoplight.
Right.
Red, yellow, green package. Well, what if I just want one pepper?
Right.
What if you live alone and you're not going to use all that? I think any time you have choice in the amount of food you buy at either a supermarket or a restaurant, you're going to have less waste.
So do you think this is – there's always this argument about what changes these things. And there are a lot of people who say personal behavior changes it. And other people would argue that you have to have, in some senses, major policy shifts and the way we have things done if we want to change this process, want to change this way of wasting food, I should say.
Yeah. I think the two can go hand in hand, where you can have this popular clamoring for changed ways, say, at the supermarket, but large-scale change won't happen unless there's a few things that occur on a legislative level, really getting an emphasis on keeping food out of the landfill. So I mentioned before about increased composting, and at the top of my wish list, as I wrote in the last chapter in American Wasteland, is getting people to ban organics from the landfill. So make it illegal to send food or yard waste to a landfill facility where it only aids climate change through methane emissions.
The methane piece is important.
It is. And that, methane is 25 times as potent as CO2 at trapping heat, but we don't really hear about it much. There certainly are more CO2 emissions out there, but methane's very potent at trapping heat and aiding climate change. So really, whatever we can do to keep food out of the landfill, I'm all for it. And to me, the simplest, most elegant step would be a wide-scale ban on food to landfills. And I think that would have sweeping effects all through the food chain on how we approach food.
And some parts of the European Union are actually doing this, and you wrote about that in the book as well.
Yeah, it has happened in a few countries, Norway being one of them, where they've had some real success. Partly the reason we haven't seen it in the U.S. is because we have so much space. We have a lot of open land to build landfills.
To dump.
To
dump.
And it's a pretty old solution. Dig a hole in the ground and fill it with our trash. There have been some advances for sure, but even the landfills that are forced to capture methane, the systems they have in place are pretty inefficient, and so they're only getting about half of that methane.
You spent a lot of time in this book. A lot of time writing this book.
I did.
Researching, talking to people. What we didn't have time for, I think it may be important to throw out a couple of these, some things were in Baltimore. You talked about Sinai Hospital and their effort to try to save money on food. You threw that in there and some other things, but that it's the people that you write this through, the stories of human beings, of their lives, of what they went through.
Yeah, I try and talk about people and tell some stories and make the book approachable, but there's this one couple that I always like to talk about.
Which couple is that?
Roy and Diane, and they had spent a few years homeless.
Oh, this is the couple in North Carolina.
Yeah, they're from near where I live in North Carolina.
Right.
And to me, it's so easy to talk about hunger on a hypothetical level, but you meet two people and you sit in their living room and ask them what it was like to not know where their next meal is coming from, and to see Diane tear up as she's recalling not knowing where that next meal is coming from and having to beg her neighbors for something to eat, that really hits home, and it really forces you to think about how we can redistribute food better and prevent that situation where you go to a restaurant and they feed you just a nauseating amount of food the portions that they give you are just so massive.
Especially the more inexpensive restaurants are massive. The most expensive restaurants give you not enough food.
Well, that's a separate problem.
and the inexpensive restaurants just clog your plate full of stuff you just can't eat.
Yeah, and it's almost as if that's become the norm to put you in this position where you can overeat or you can waste food. So hopefully, you know, there's a third way of taking food home, taking leftovers home. But to me, it's very important to think about it before that food hits your plate. So changing it in what you can do at home, but then also hopefully some of our legislators and policymakers can do a better job helping us curb food waste.
So I'm curious about that, you, Jonathan Bloom, about you. I mean, you're a journalist.
Yes.
This is your world. But this could be a book that you should write, and you can go on to write about bonobo chimps in West Africa, if you like. But it's clearly something else is going on. This is because you have this blog on wasted food. You got this book. So this has become, for you, a passion. This has become, for you, something you have to talk about and write about. So,
yeah, I started this book as a journalist, and I finished it as more of an activist. And it is something that I care deeply about, and so it would be difficult to immediately turn to the next topic and just keep working on whatever it may be as a journalist. But for the time being, I'm going around giving talks on food waste and continuing to write about it a bit here and there, and also doing some consulting work to try and get businesses and institutions to do a better job in curbing waste.
And so, I mean, is this something that you see that, you know, just like people think about a food movement that has started for better food, and people, whether they live in the poorest neighborhoods or the middle class or wealthy neighborhoods, are demanding access to better food and having better food, that this is part and parcel of how we think about our food, our food system, our lives. This is a piece of all that. This is not something that says this is just about food waste alone.
I think it needs to be part of that food sustainability conversation. And unfortunately, it doesn't get brought up quite as much as eating local food or eating organic, food justice issues. And certainly they're all important causes, but I think it is all linked. And especially when you think about obesity, and the link between waste and obesity is an odd one, but the common culprit are these massive portions that we receive at restaurants, and frankly, the ideas that have creeped into our own homes on what's a sensible amount of food to eat.
So we've been talking about Jonathan Bloom. He has an incredible blog, which I really recommend people check out. It's called wastedfood.com. It'll be linked to on our website here. And the book is American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. And Jonathan Bloom, thank you so much for coming through town and being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a nice chat.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.